Just when everything seems to be in good order, something goes wrong. You thought you had a perfect job, or a perfect marriage, or perfect children. It's hard to believe anyone could believe that, but we are sometimes shocked at how imperfect all of these things in life are. Or we try to accomplish some goal and we labor greatly at it. We do all the things that should go into a successful achievement of that goal. And for one reason or another, it's taken from us. Imagine what those people in Katrina last year must have felt like as all of their life's work in terms of dwelling places and so many memories and other valuable things that were connected with their lives were gone in a very short space of time. Life is full of such frustrations. A young person is cut down by death in the midst of the beginnings of a great career in whatever. This happens all the time. We live in a world that is full of frustrations, full of injustice. We see that people who are criminals get off scot-free. Those who are innocent end up being put to death, and especially those who are the called according to the glory of the gospel of Jesus Christ. As we speak, there are some throughout the world who are being killed for their faith. They are being put to death because they love the Lord Jesus. And so we might ask, and there are times when I'm sure in sober moments we all ask, what's the use? What's the use? I'm going to die. I don't know about you, but when I read obituaries, it's always interesting that one life gets reduced in a sense to one column, maybe two if you accomplished a few things. And there it is, soon to be forgotten, even with the great, soon to be forgotten by most and usually all people, period. And so what is the use? What is the use? Why bother to seek anything good? Why bother to achieve any goal, whether it's natural or spiritual? We live in a wacky world. We live in a world that is obviously not the way it was designed from a Christian perspective. What is the use? Why should we continue on? And in fact, why didn't God just take us to be with Himself when He saved us by His grace? Well, the book of Ecclesiastes has some wonderful answers. And as we look over the next number of weeks and months at this book, I hope you will see those answers with me, and the Lord will strengthen us to learn to be wiser and more useful and more hopeful in the midst of a crazy world in which so much is out of whack. And so there are three basic interpretations. There are actually, I think, about five, but a couple of them aren't really worth mentioning. How do we interpret this? Because as you look at it, you have a man who's writing, and we're really not sure who it is. He writes from the perspective of Solomon. It's an inspired work, and yet there is so much that's negative. He looks at life. It says it's vanity. It is out of whack. It's not the way it should be. Life is filled with frustration and futility. And yet he comes to also say, worship God, obey Him, fear Him, and follow Him. And what are we to make of this interesting juxtaposition of the good and the bad? What looks like a cynic in a way, and this is the way many liberal critical scholars have looked at it, is it's simply the work of a cynic. It's sort of like the ex-fundamentalist or the former evangelical, and there are clubs out there of former church members or former Christians that are cynical about the Christian life. Life ultimately is meaningless or absurd. He is a sort of early day Camus, and we clearly as believers do not want to take that position, nor do we think, or should we think, that the text itself would lead us to believe that this is a purely cynical view of life, or a cynical view really at all. But the second one is the view that most evangelicals take, and it's one we're going to take exception to in some ways. And I probably wouldn't be preaching on Ecclesiastes if I hadn't learned this third view. But the second view is the typical one that I've believed for years. And it has a lot of truth to it, but it doesn't quite measure up to the whole of the text of Ecclesiastes. And the second view is what we might call the evangelistic view, where the writer takes on the view of what the world would look like from an unbeliever's perspective. But then from a believer's perspective, we know that it's really not that way. And that's the view of the evangelist. And that doesn't quite match up, because in fact, the world really is that way. It's really the way that the writer of Ecclesiastes is saying that it is. And so this is what I would like to call, and I think a few others, and there aren't many in this camp that believe this, the realist view. Now, two people, and I want to give credit here. I know this will be listened to beyond this room as well, and I want you to know that Meredith M. Klein, who teaches at Gordon-Conwell, he's the son of Meredith K. Klein, and probably few of you have met Meredith M. He is not very well known, but he's also, like his dad, thoroughly committed. He loves the Word of God and is a member of our church in Ipswich, as well as a professor at Gordon-Conwell Seminary, and he's also a librarian there. And he taught a course here once on this subject, and he spent his whole adult life basically studying, doing his doctoral work on the book of Ecclesiastes. He's working on a commentary, and I hope he'll come out with it, because no one, and I mean no one, I read 7 or 8 commentaries this week, no one has the richness and I think the accuracy of the perspective that he has, except one person, and he didn't write enough on it, and that is J.I. Packer. If you check in his book, Knowing God, and it'll be on different pages and different editions, but if you check, there's a section, and it actually talks about Ecclesiastes for 3 or 4 pages, and he takes this realistic view. And I love this realistic view, because what it's saying is that the writer sees the way the world really is under heaven. And he teaches us how, by the grace of heaven, by the wisdom of heaven, to live in it faithfully. But he has a realistic view of the way things really are in a fallen world. And so, that's the theme of this text, 1 through 11 of Ecclesiastes, that the world is out of whack. The world is out of whack, and we'll see in a moment why I use that word whack and wacky. I think it's memorable, and I also think it's an excellent and accurate single word for the word vanity, which I think is somewhat misleading as an English translation. But who is the author? Well, what we notice here is that the author is not the preacher, or actually preacher is not such a great translation, it's not terrible, but Koheleth is a mysterious word. And what the writer, the inspired writer here, he is what we might call the framer. If you notice, he begins and sets a frame for us in these first 2 verses, and then he ends in a similar way in chapter 12. He sets a frame, and then he gives us 3 panels of truth. There's a wonderful, detailed, intricate pattern to what he writes, and it all brings home the points that he's making about the vanity of the world and the goodness of God in a pretty powerful way. So he is the one, the inspired writer is the one who describes this Solomonic figure, and there's been many, many of Orthodox Bible-believing interpreters have agreed that this probably wasn't written by Solomon, although some think it's written later. I believe that there's evidence that it was written in the theocracy during the period of the kings, and it's clearly written with a knowledge of all that Solomon knew about the world, because he was so wealthy and so diverse in his knowledge and experience of the good things of this created order. But we don't really know what the word Koheleth means. It means probably something like one who assembles. And most likely one, and the word is used in other parts of the Old Testament, when the temple was dedicated under Solomon, he Koheleth, or assemble the people together. And so he is an assembler of the people. And I think there's also evidence in the text to say that he is an assembler of words. He is an assembler of wise words of wisdom. He is an assembler of proverbs, and we know that Solomon was just that, which help us to live in a fallen world in a way that is wise. And so the words of Koheleth, the son of David, king of Jerusalem, or king in Jerusalem, a somewhat odd way of saying that. And it may be Solomon. I wouldn't doubt that either. I don't think it's worth arguing about. What we do know is that it's inspired, and what we do know is that it brings a kind of Solomonic perspective on the world. But it is a mysterious book, and we should not be afraid of taking account for the mysterious, both in the Bible and in the nature of God and life, the life that he has called us to live. It's full of mystery. And it's one of the things that we learn about life, is that there are no straight line equations, as we will see in a moment. But what is the situation then? There is no covenant name of God here, and that's what's led some to say it must be a post-exilic, after the exile. I believe that there's lots of evidence to believe that it is during the theocracy. It is in the period of the kingdom, but it steps outside the kingdom to look at the way life is in the common fallen order of things. So it's Solomon's perspective on a fallen world, a Solomonic perspective. And what it shows us is that while the theocracy, okay, the kingdom of David and Solomon, is a sketch, it's a type of the glorious kingdom, which is a straight line perfection, okay? Obey God and be fully blessed. Fully obey God and be fully blessed. It is, as it were, the covenant of works. It's a picture of the covenant of works being fulfilled. Now, we know in reality that it was far, far from being fulfilled, because everyone, including Solomon and David, were imperfect people. But it's in that context, then, that perfection, which many wrongly thought they could live out in this world, and that is this straight line equation: if I obey God, he will bless me. And I think that most of the Christian world believes that that's true today. If I obey God, he will bless me in this life, and I will be blessed. If I really obey God, he will make me wealthy, some preachers say. That's a straight line equation. We still tend to think that way. Surely I will not suffer. And therein lies a very dangerous error. And I think it's an error that the writer of Ecclesiastes, by God's inspired wisdom, is seeking to disabuse us of, because he knows that it only if we take that unrealistic Pollyanna view of the Christian faith, or another way of putting it, if we try to get the perfection that is yet to come, truly will come, and make it happen in this world, we are going to be sorely disappointed, and it will undermine our faith. And we'll get much more of that in the weeks to come. And I want to read to you 8:14, just that one verse for a moment. 8:14, there is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity. See, he proves his point. It's just not a straight line equation. The righteous have bad things happen to them, and the wicked have good things happen to them. And it just doesn't seem fair. It's really not the way things ought to be. And that's why now I would like to translate the motto of the book, which is verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Now, he repeats the word vanity, hebel, is the Hebrew word. He repeats this and he doubles it up, which in the Hebrew is an intensifying of the word. So it's, as I love the way Meredith M. not only does he translate this wackiness, but he says, he translates this, as a good New Englander, wicked wacky. Now, if we say something is wicked funny, we mean it's very funny. And he's saying the world is wicked wacky. It's very wacky. It's crazy. It's out of whack in a big way. So you'll remember this now, won't you? And even our kids will remember this. It's a wacky world. And I think there was a movie in the 60s with that in the title. But it's exactly what this word means. And it's a multidimensional word. I won't go so far as to say that one word summarizes it all, but I think it's better than simply vanity or emptiness. It's certainly meaninglessness would be one translation, but that really doesn't encompass the whole of the word. And you'll see in a moment why I think it's important to translate it wacky. So, wackiest wackiness, or wicked wacky, says the preacher, wackiest wackiness, all is wacky or out of whack. This word is used in the book of Ecclesiastes 38 times, so it's central to the understanding of the text. And what it means, what the word hebel or wacky means, is that it's irrational, it doesn't make sense, it doesn't fit the way things ought to be. Okay, if you went to a NASCAR race and the cars are all driving backwards and going the wrong way over the finish line, you'd go, wait a minute, what is going on here? It's not the way things should be. It's not the way NASCAR races work. And if they started with a ninth inning in baseball, although there are some women who go to baseball games with their husbands that wish it started and ended in the ninth inning, but that would be crazy. It wouldn't be the way it was designed to be, and we would recognize that. And that's exactly what the writer says here, is that things are not according to design. They are incongruous. And as a result now, what Koheleth, who we might call him Q, the preacher, will teach us then, is that this wackiness has many different dimensions. It leads to a sense of frustration. It leads to a sense of futility. It leads to a lack of satisfaction. It leads to a sense of meaninglessness. So all of these is a kind of a rich, rich portrait of the world in its fallen condition. And so, ultimately, of course, the ultimate frustration is that death takes it all. Whatever we may accomplish in this life and whatever frustrations we have endured, finally, death gets us. And that's true for Christians and non-Christians alike, except, as we'll see, the Christian has a very different perspective on all of it. Now, along with this, then, we need to look, that's really verses 1 and 2 that we've looked at, and now 3 through 11, and then we're going to break it into two parts. 3 through 8 is actually a poem, and I noticed that our New King James says that it's all a poem through 11. That may be. I'm not a Hebrew expert, though I read it to prepare for sermons. But as I looked at the evidence, I'm thinking that what's happening here is that 3 through 8 is a poem, and that probably in poetic language, 9 through 11 gives us the interpretation or commentary on that poem. And if you look at it, it's really quite remarkable. And we want to understand, as we think about poetry in the Bible, and I've thought about this a lot in recent years, that beauty and truth, that is, structure that is carefully thought out to be beautiful, to be memorable, to be something that we can remember because we hear it in our ears, that those two things, that and truth, go together. They go hand in hand. And if you look all the way at the end of the book, 12:10, you'll see this. The preacher sought to find, and here acceptable is just not a great word to use for this. It should be what they have in the margin. Delightful words, beautiful words, lovely words. He sought to find lovely words, and what was written was upright words of truth. One of the big biblical words for truth in the Old Testament, emet. And there, truth and beauty go hand in hand. And it makes perfect sense because God, who is truth, created all the world with its beauty, with its intricacies and majesty. And so we would expect that to be reflected in the writing of one who is observing the world. And Koheleth is a master writer. He is a master wordsmith. And we'll be pointing out the ways in which he is as we look through this book. Now, he begins by saying, what profit has a man from all his labor? Again, we've got to unpack that word. Sometimes what happens as we hear the Bible repeated over and over again is that instead of it meaning more to us, it means less, because we hear the words so often, we never really think about what they mean. And so what's he talking about here? What profit has man from all his labor? Does it mean how much does he get an hour? No. Well, in fact, the word for profit here is more, we might translate it, and this is a good word, it's just that we've got to remember what it means in the context. It means something like ultimate satisfaction. So out of all of our labor, what sense of ultimate satisfaction do we get? I was telling my mom tonight, or this afternoon, as I was trying to shake the sleep out of my brain after a nap, that one of the things I love the most, the time I love most in the week after worship itself, is when I'm done with the day and I go home and I collapse in my chair and relax. And there's a sense of satisfaction. We've worshiped together. We've met together. We've met God and one another. And there's a great sense of joy and satisfaction in that. But then before you know it, the evening is over. I've gone to bed and I wake up on Monday with a list of things to do around the house and have to do it all over again. There's no ultimate satisfaction. So he's using that word in the sense that everyone knows what it is to be satisfied and take rest in an accomplishment, small or great. And what he's saying is there ultimate satisfaction in all of the labor of man? Is there? And of course, the answer that he gives is found in 2:11, just one chapter ahead, when he says, "Then I looked on all the works of my hands had done, and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity, all was out of whack, and grasping for wind. There was no ultimate satisfaction under the sun." And so this is truly the way it is. See, he's not putting himself in the unbeliever's shoes. He's saying this is the way it is for all of us, believer and unbeliever. There is no ultimate satisfaction under the sun. And there's a phrase we also need to explore. It's almost used as many times as hebel, vanity, or wackiness. And this is very important. And here I was amazed. When I looked at the commentaries, I didn't see one single commentary that really got the point. What most said, now these are the best commentaries, what most said was, under the sun means life in this world, that is, in the realm of the visible creation. And a couple of times, actually three, the writer actually uses the phrase under heaven. In the pagan world in which the writer was writing, in the ancient Near East, the sun, as probably you all know, in Egypt and in Mesopotamian mythology, was looked at as being a god. And it was the god who judged, especially in Mesopotamian mythology. The sun was the god who judged men in their waywardness. He was sort of as a frightening figure. And I believe that there is evidence throughout the Bible that the true and living God now, not the idols of the nations, is in fact the one who judges. There is a kind of spine-tingling or spine-chilling sound to this word. It's not just locating us under heaven, but it's saying we are under the judgment of heaven. We are living in a world with which God is supremely displeased. We are sinners. And we are the reason that things are out of whack. Paul says it in Romans 1. He says, for the wrath of God is revealed. We might, because of the tense there in the Greek, say it continuously reveals. The wrath of God, or it is continuously revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. And so being under heaven means being under the condemnation of God, who dwells in heaven where there is perfection and holiness, where there is no sin and where there is no death. And so we have this picture then of the writer is living and recognizing that we live in this realm of the age of death. It's not just the created order, but it's the created order under the curse of God. That's the world in which we live. And the world, the way it really is one which most of all unbelievers would like to dismiss. It's funny, they say that we're the ones that look at the world through rose-colored glasses, and I'm afraid sometimes we do. But unbelief doesn't really enable anyone to see the world as it really is. And I sometimes think that those who are pessimists and depressed have a more accurate view of reality the way it really is. We'll get to that in closing. But the fact is that being under the sun is not to be in a good place with God. And so then we go and look at the endless cycles. And now here, the poetry, of course, speaks for itself in a way. But we see three panels in 3 to 8. There are three sections. We have 3 and 4. Excuse me. It's 4 to, he asked the question then, what profit is there under the sun? And then there's 4 and 5. 6 is in the center. And then 7 and 8. And yes, it's your favorite structure in biblical literature, a kind of chiasm with 6 being at the center. And notice what he does now is he uses three different natural things. He uses the sun, he uses the wind, and he uses the rivers in order to emphasize and make memorable to us the fact of how human life is, that it cycles without satisfaction, without an ultimate end. And so, also, and here, again, it's in the original language, you would see the word for going and coming, and it appears in the first panel, 4 and 5, once, in the second panel, verse 6, twice, in the third panel, 7 and 8, 3 times. And so, at the center of it then, you get this wonderful statement, and the wind, it turns around to the north, and the wind whirls about continually. And if you watch the National Weather Service, you see that this is true. There's always a new weather pattern. The winds are always swirling and turning, and we have different patterns that are there, but it's always in motion, always changing. The moment we have a glorious day like we did for part of this afternoon, before you know it, it's gone and something else is happening. That's the way life is. And there's never, see, at the end of all this going, and he intensifies this concept, going and going and going and going and going and going. There's no end to the cycles. There's no ultimate satisfaction under the sun. And so, there's no ultimate satisfaction in all the labors of men, however good they may be. And then he says, in a sense, again asking now, what's the use, therefore? And in verses 9 through 11, he gives a commentary on the poetry of 3 through 8. And he says this, with all of these things, with every generation passing, and one comes and one goes, and they replace one another, and the eye and the ear can never be filled with hearing or seeing, in verses 7 and 8, just like the rivers that fill the sea and go back and continue to fill them. Now he says, that which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there's nothing new under the sun. Now some wit might say, wait a minute. Dean Kamen has invented several new things in his lifetime. What do you mean there's nothing new under the sun? Well, we surely don't mean that. In fact, there were inventions, although not quite as rapidly occurring in Solomon's day. He discovered things that hadn't been discovered, and so to say there's nothing new in that sense is not true. So what does he mean? What he means is that this cycle of labor and frustration, of life and death, of work, toil, sweat, and death doesn't end. It's the same today as it was in Solomon's day, as it was, as he says, in ancient times. And so that's why we read Romans 8, verses 20 and 21, for the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it in hope, because the creation itself also will be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. So the fallen situation remains. We live in this present evil age, an age which is dominated by sin and dominated by death. Interesting and important there in verse 10. Said, it has already been in eternity. That's what the word ancient times is, a word in Hebrew, olam, and it means eternity. Now, it can be used for something that is ancient or old as well, but there is a hint here. And here again, the artistry of the writer. There is a hint that there is something more as he looks through this beautiful and troubling poetry at the world the way it is, out of whack, leaving us unsatisfied ultimately. There is a hint of eternity. And so even in the phrase under heaven, there is another world that while we are being judged by it, yet there is hope to enter it, as Paul says, through the glorious liberty created by Jesus Christ for the sons or the children of God. And so we might ask, and we've really already answered it several times, why is the world out of whack? And the answer, of course, is that the world is out of whack because of sin. God created all things good, and the writer of Ecclesiastes will say that in verse 7:29. God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes or many inventions and devices. So it was us that corrupted the world. It was Adam that corrupted the world. That's why it's not according to the way that God designed it. Robert Frost, who was, as far as I know, not a believer, wrote a wonderful poem called Nothing Gold Can Stay. Incidentally, it's not about colorful leaves in the fall, but about that brief moment of gold in the trees in the spring as the first buds come out, but then quickly the leaves follow and we miss the gold. And he wrote this amazing poem, very brief. Nature's first green is gold, her hardest hue to hold, her early leaves a flower, but only so an hour. Then leaf subsides to leaf, so Eden sank to grief. So dawn goes down today, nothing gold can stay. So he, as a poet with deep insight into the nature of reality, really took up one of the themes accurately of the writer of Koheleth in understanding that nothing gold can stay, that the beauty and the good things of life have a way of slipping away from us, and ultimately they're taken in death. And he knew that something happened in Eden. Whether he believed that was the historical fall or not, we don't. But it's a profound poem. And so we live then in this normal state under the sun since the fall of Adam, in the state of common cursing and blessing. And we've got to understand this as Reformed people. I hear so many people saying, oh, the doctrine of common grace, that's not biblical. Yes, it is biblical. In fact, if it isn't, we don't understand tons about the way we're to live in this world. Common grace doesn't mean that special grace is common. Common grace means that there's also something that nobody deserves, and that's God's kindness to a fallen world. And it's clearly what the writer of Ecclesiastes says. God's kindness is given to those who are wicked and don't love or follow him. And then bad things happen. Evils occur to those who love God, who are his disciples, his children in this world. And that's the way the world is. Common curse and common blessing. Work which is created good in Genesis 1 we find is labor, toil, and brings a lack of satisfaction in Ecclesiastes. And yet he will also tell us that we should still continue to work and enjoy its labors, but understand that they are, or enjoy its fruits, and understand that they are temporary. And so the base problem, of course, is that we worship the creation more than the Creator. We seek to find our happiness in the things in this natural order. And that's what's so out of whack, because our ultimate satisfaction can only be found in the God of the Bible, who sent his own Son into the world to save us from its vanity, from the endless cycles of dissatisfaction that are built into it by God in order that we might be turned to him. That is the solution. And our final point, which is really our conclusion, is that the solution for the wackiness in this world is the beauty and power of heaven, which has come to us in the gospel of Jesus Christ, which the writer of Ecclesiastes knew in the sacrificial system, in the priesthood of the theocracy. He would have known this. It's only hinted at throughout the book. It creates, in a sense, a hunger in us and reminds us that if we seek ultimate happiness in this world, we will be frustrated. And if we think there are straight line equations, and I'm always, especially as a pastor, troubled and hurt when I see other Christians believing, and especially preachers teaching, that if you obey God, he will bless you in this world richly. I thank God when he does bless us. And if you go out and work hard, he will ordinarily give you enough to shelter yourself, to clothe yourself, and to eat. But there are no straight lines because there's no ultimate happiness there. And there are no straight lines because your house may be swept away with all the unbelievers in a flood, in a hurricane, or in a terrible war. Your life may be taken from you because you believe in the Lord Jesus Christ or because you get cancer. That's the world we live in. There are no straight line equations. What's interesting is that in the gospel, everything's turned upside down now, because death, which takes away, that's the ultimate dissatisfaction, it takes away everything that the unbeliever hopes to gain in the way of happiness. But then death for the believer brings us truly into a place of perfect and unmitigated blessedness, a place where there is unalloyed happiness and joy. That's what death will bring to us. And this is because only in heaven, and heaven come down to earth in Christ, is there real hope to overcome the dissatisfaction that comes from living in a wacky world and trusting in the created order. And I believe, brothers and sisters, that we ought to challenge unbelievers with the truth of Ecclesiastes. I don't think we've used it enough as an evangelistic tool. I think that Sinclair Ferguson has written something called The Pundit's Folly, which doesn't completely take this view, but it's an excellent book that uses some of the insights of Ecclesiastes as an evangelistic tract, and something that I would recommend. But for us, then, we need to tell people that their sense that there's no hope in this world is accurate. They may get discouraged, or we may need to disabuse them. Often, this is what we need to do. That what they think they're going to find happiness in is illusion. It's an illusory, passing satisfaction. There is no happiness here. And that God has designed it this way since the fall, because he wants us to find our happiness in him. That's what he created us to do. It's not according to design that we should worship the creature or anything in his creation except him. And that's what Christ brings us back to. And that heavenly treasure is the one, then, that we will live by and have hope in this wacky world.